Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 506, titled The Road to Lugano, Part 2, More About the Bush Administration, the Underground Reich, and the Peak Oil Controversy. This is being recorded on April 10th of the year 2005. And what we're going to do now is to once again resume with the tale of the Leuna facility. You're going to hear an excerpt to begin, a pretty long excerpt from For the Record program number 278. For the Record program 278 was recorded in the spring of 2001, and we're going to be listening to some discussion of the Leuna plant. By the way, at that point in time, I didn't know how that was pronounced. I thought it was pronounced Leuna, but it's actually pronounced Leuna, L-E-U-N-A. Nonetheless, we're going to hear once again an excerpt from the book The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben by Joseph Borkin about a critical air engagement of World War II, namely what was called by the 8th Air Force the Battle of Leuna. Specifically, one of the key elements in knocking out German industrial production was neutralizing its fuel production capability. And again, synthetic oil developed by the Bergius process developed by the Germany's synthetic oil plants provided most of Germany's fuel in World War II. It wasn't economically competitive with natural oil at the time due to the low price of oil and the relative inefficiency of the process. Germany was able to make up for that economically by the use of slave labor. Again, in For the Record 385, I voiced my opinion that quote, novel, unquote, the formula by Steve Shagan was, in fact, the disclosure of sensitive intelligence information that could not be overtly disseminated, and indeed other of Shagan's novels appear to be a similar thing, sort of like what was seen in the movie 3 Days of the Condor, featuring Robert Redford and Faye Dunaway. The notion that the Bergius process, the hydrogenation process, has not in any way been improved since 1929 simply defies belief, given the significance of the 1929 Standard IG Agreement and the pivotal importance of petroleum in the world's industrial economy. We're going to be listening in the following segment of For the Record 278, again recorded in the spring of 2000, actually the late winter of 2001. We're going to be hearing a number of things after the discussion of the Battle of Leuna from The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. We're going to be listening to an excerpt of an article from the New York Times, Big Kickbacks Under Coal Reported by Roger Cohen and John Taliabu, that from the New York Times of February 7th of 2000. And we're going to be listening to discussion of the interrelationship between the Thiessen firm and the Total ELF firm, then ELF Aquitaine, in purchasing the rebuilt Leuna facility after World War II. It was bombed in World War II, the Soviets rebuilt it, and in the early 90s, that Leuna facility, the same one you heard discussed in part one of this broadcast, was the focal point of a major element of maneuvering between powerful political and economic interests. Disclosure of that brought down Helmut Kohl, but the important thing is that the Leuna facility was, once again, the focal point of major activity. We should note in this regard that the Leuna facility can also be used for other things. The high-pressure process can be used to develop nitrates for the production of fertilizer and other things, but I suspect very strongly that in the maneuvering around the Leuna facility, we are looking at a partial recapitulation of the Standard IG Agreement of 1929, and it may very well be that the, quote, peak oil controversy, unquote, is intended not only to affect some very serious worldwide machinations, including getting rid of a lot of folks, but also to rehabilitate the Standard IG Agreement and to realize the potential of that powerful cartel agreement from 1929. We're also going to hear information from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, reviewing the connections between the Thiessen firm, which helped to buy the Leuna facility, and the Underground Reich and the Bormann Group, and the Bush family. So here is an excerpt from For the Record program number 278 from the winter of 2001. We're going to turn now to one of the best books about I.G. Farben. It's titled The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, authored by Joseph Borken, published in hardcover by the Free Press, a division of Macmillan, copyright 1978, ISBN 0-02-904630-0. And of the Leuna Refinery and its destruction in May of 1944, this being called the Battle of Leuna, we read as follows. May 12, 1944 was a fateful day for Germany and for IG. On that day, the United States 8th Air Force sent 935 bombers over Germany to attack its synthetic oil industry. 200 bombers concentrated on IG's Leuna plant alone. This attack marked the beginning of what the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey called the Battle of Leuna, classifying it as one of the major battles of the war, unquote, and skipping down of the report to Hitler of an IG Farben official named Kroc. He told Hitler that Germany's position was hopeless if the enemy air raids on the synthetic oil plants continued. To support his grim forecast, he presented Hitler with an impressive array of facts and figures, skipping down. The only thing to do was to try to put the plants back in operation as quickly as possible, and then protect them with a heavy defensive air cover. Speer gave the restoration project the highest priority for men and materiel. 350,000 workers were assigned to the task of restoring German oil production. At Leuna, the effort succeeded in bringing the facilities back to partial operation within 10 days, but on May 28th, the 8th Air Force resumed the Battle of Leuna. The result was another crippling blow, which reduced German fuel production by half. By the way, the Speer referred to there is German Armaments Minister Albert Speer. Continuing. And skipping down, the course of the Battle of Leuna became the gauge for the state of German oil production. By early July, the resourceful IG technicians were able to restore Leuna to 75% operating capacity. However, the 8th Air Force returned again on July 7th, again bombing the plant to a halt. 2 days later, the plant started operating again and by July 19th had reached 53% of capacity. And so the cycle of bombings and reconstruction continued. But the total effect on German fuel production was nothing less than catastrophic. Kroc concluded that the only way fuel installations could be rebuilt after each raid was to cannibalize other installations. Under this plan to prevent the total cessation of oil production, Germany's productive capacity diminished with each recuperation. By September, oil production had dropped to 15%, a condition from which Germany was never to recover. And that again from the Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben about the history of the Leuna Refinery in World War II. Now we're going to reprise a section of For the Record program number 193. This in turn is an excerpt of a New York Times article about the role of the Leuna Refinery in the CDU funding scandal. And we're going to hear a couple of interesting names, bearing in mind the dizzying connection that the many connections between the dots that we have already covered. This again from For the Record program number 193.
Bernard Gorny, G-O-R-N-Y, Mr. Guillon's lawyer, declined to comment. On the same day that Nobel PAC received the money in 1992, it wired 220 million francs, or $33.8 million, to a company registered in Liechtenstein called Standby Establishment, and the remaining $5.2 million to the Swiss account of a company called Showfast Limited. Swiss prosecutors say both companies appeared to be controlled by Mr. Lettier and Mr. Holzer, who have not denied receiving the sums. The money was later moved, at least in part, to Liechtenstein foundations. Paul Perraudin, a Geneva prosecutor, has told Le Monde that one foundation, Delta International, is believed to be a front for Mr. Holzer's activities. Another, Foundation Thais, T-H-A-I-S, is thought to be a front for Mr. Lettier. Some of these accounts were frozen in January. Swiss and French prosecutors believe that Mr. Gelfi received more than $4 million for his services. Those included a second use of this company in 1993 with a payment of over $20 million by Thyssen in connection with its partnership with ELF in certain projects at Leuna. Mr. Gelfi justified the payment, bringing total commissions paid to about $60 million by producing false, quote, feasibility studies, unquote. At the groundbreaking ceremony for the new Leuna refinery in 1994, Mr. Kohl called it, quote, the most important Franco-German industrial project since World War II, unquote. He did not explain why. So again, note this dizzying tangle of corporate fronts. Note also that in addition to being the company that manufactured the tanks in this Saudi Arabian tank deal that is one of the sources of these mysterious monies, note also that Thiessen apparently was involved with certain projects with ELF at the Leuna refinery. So again, the Thiessen group, not only one of the main elements in German heavy industry, but one of the central tiles, so to speak, in the mosaic of the Bormann organization, figures in both the tank and the ELF refinery deal at Leuna.
That, again, is from For the Record program number 193. Now, bearing in mind the Thiessen involvement with Leuna Refinery, I mispronounced that, and bear in mind also the CDU funding scandal, and that was the focal point of 193, we're going to return once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. Now, of the role of I.G. Farben in the Bormann organization, Paul Manning writes as follows. The Bormann organization continues to wield enormous economic influence. Wealth continues to flow into the treasuries of its corporate entities in South America, the United States, and Europe. Vastly diversified, it is said to be the largest landowner in South America, and through stock holdings controls German heavy industry and the trust established by the late Hermann Schmitz, former president of IG Farben, who held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers. Now, note, too, that the Thiessen Group is one of the principal elements in the Bormann organization, as we've looked at in numerous broadcasts, resuming now, for the purposes of review, discussion of the Bormann Group and Thiessen, turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, of the post-war fate of the Thiessen Industrial Empire and its connections with the Bormann Group, we read, during the final year of his life in Argentina, dividing his time between the villa in Buenos Aires and the ranches, one in Argentina, the other in Paraguay, Fritz Thiessen completed establishing the control that would assure everlasting family prosperity through Thiessen AG. Elder grandson Count Federico Zichy Thiessen of Buenos Aires was placed on the board of this German steel trust. When the Count votes at board meetings in Dusseldorf 3 or 4 times a year, he votes for the entire Thiessen family of South America and Europe. Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, who has a younger brother, Count Claudio Zichy Thiessen, represents the largest single shareholding group with 25% of the stock in Thiessen AG. The remainder of the stock is diffused into Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt and Buenos Aires, which holds shares for many individuals on both continents, including those representing the Bormann Group. So note the connection between the Bormann Group and Thiessen AG. And of the close connection between Martin Bormann himself and the Thiessen family, we read once again from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by way of review. Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, grandson of old Fritz Thiessen, Claudio Zichy Thiessen, and their families are intimate friends of Bormann. Because of this friendship, Martin Bormann has 3 sanctuaries, his own pompous spread in Argentina, and the Thiessen ranches in Argentina and Paraguay. By the way, pompous is P-A-M-P-A-S. We're going to turn now to an excerpt of For the Record program number 273. This deals with the Bush family and the Union Banking Corporation and the Thiessens. This is from For the Record program number 273, B as in Bush, B as in Bormann. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Sarasota Herald Tribune of Saturday, November 11th of the year 2000. This is an article put together by the Sarasota Herald Tribune staff, headlined, Author Links Bush Family to Nazis. And this was accessed from their website, that is to say the Sarasota Herald Tribune website at www.newscoast.com. This reads in part as follows. Now, the main element here is the Union Banking Corporation and the Bush family, and as it develops, the Bush family fortune comes from the post-war liquidation of the Union Bank in 1951. The article reads, again, Sarasota Herald Tribune, 11/11/2000. The president of the Florida Holocaust Museum said Saturday that George W. Bush's grandfather derived a portion of his personal fortune through his affiliation with a Nazi-controlled bank. John Loftus, a former prosecutor in the Justice Department's Nazi War Crimes Unit,
said his research found that Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, was a principal in the Union Banking Corporation in Manhattan in the late 1930s and the 1940s. Now, here's the really important part here. That is by way of review for veteran listeners. Listen to this. Leading Nazi industrialists secretly owned the bank at that time, Loftus said, and were moving money into it through a second bank in Holland, even after the United States declared war on Germany. The bank was liquidated in 1951, Loftus said, and Bush's grandfather and great-grandfather received $1.5 million from the bank as part of that dissolution. Quote, "That's where the Bush family fortune came from. It came from the Third Reich," unquote, Loftus said.
That, again, an excerpt from For the Record program number 278. What we're going to do next is to take a look at some information that we looked at in For the Record 478, and specifically we're going to look at some information from the article The Coming Panic Over the End of Oil, Coming to a Ballot Box Near You. This was posted on Scoop, an online publication. It was authored by the late Walter Shaysby and posted on December 24th of the year 2003. Now, one of the things Shaysby tackles here is that the peak oil controversy, or the peak oil advocates, are themselves people who are very much connected to the petroleum industry itself. Although they're not all wild exponents of just ripping the whole earth apart in order to get all the oil we can. Basically, when we're looking at the peak oil controversy, what we're looking at basically is the foxes guarding the hen house and saying, my goodness, we're running out of hens. That's really not an inaccurate situation at all. And we're going to take a look at Contreras' situation here, basically Walter Shaysby's discussion here. One of the primary advocates of the peak oil situation is a fellow named Matthew E. Simmons. Walter Shaysby writes, "Well, guess what? Simmons is not only an oilionaire himself, but has been a key advisor to the Bush administration and to Vice President Cheney's 2001 Energy Task Force, as well as sitting on the Council of Foreign Relations. Simmons is a board member of Kerr-McGee Corporation, a major oil and gas producer. He insists that the U.S. government is very worried about oil depletion. However, Cheney's secretive National Energy Policy Development Group, or NEPDG, refused to make its records of closed-door meetings with industry executives public. The industry has taken a beating in public opinion since the Kyoto summit put the spotlight on global warming. And now Simmons apparently wants to make the public's fear of the end of cheap oil the drumbeat of the 2004 re-elect Bush and Cheney campaign, although a more enlightened energy policy, he worries, quote, is going to take a while, unquote. What we're going to look at next is a petroleum industry consulting group that is the epicenter for the peak oil advocacy position. We know that peak oil was first proposed by a guy named Marion King Hubert, who died in 1989, who accurately forecast the diminution of domestic petroleum reserves in the U.S. But note, now bearing in mind the Thiessen firm's maneuvering in purchasing the Leuna facility in the early 1990s, we're going to take a look now at the relationship between Petro Consultants of Geneva, which became HIS, and this is the epicenter of the peak oil advocacy situation, and HIS is a wholly owned energy consulting subsidiary of Thiessen Bornemisza Industries, turning once again to Walter Shaysby's paper. Support for a remedial program of oil exploration and development versus switching to research and development of alternative energy sources tends to be found among oil experts who are consultants to the industry. While accepting some of the values of the New Age, they largely remain loyal to their calling as oil geologists and wildcatters. The leading trio of John H. Leherrer, Colin J. Campbell, and L.F. Buzz Ivanhoe have worked for or with the leading firm modeling oil fields, Petro Consultants of Geneva. Note very carefully who feeds the data to Petro Consultants, later HIS, from which they produce their conclusions that we're running out of oil. Note this very carefully. Since the 1950s, they have been fed data on oil exploration and production by just about all the major oil companies, as well as by a network of 2,000 oil industry consultants around the world. They use this data to produce reports on various matters pertinent to the oil industry, which they sell back to the industry. Quote, "This much is known," Kenneth DeFays writes. "The loudest warnings about the predicted peak of world oil production came from petroconsultants." And still more. In a late 1998 merger, petroconsultants became HIS Energy Group, a subsidiary of Information Handling Services Group, or HIS Group, a diversified conglomerate owned by Holland America Investment Corporation, HIS Group's immediate parent company, for the Thyssen-Bornemisza Group, TBG, Incorporated. In the 1920s, George Herbert Walker and his son-in-law Prescott Bush had helped the Thyssen dynasty finance its acquisitions through Union Banking Corporation and Holland America Trading Corporation. Until his death last year, Hans Heinrich Thyssen-Bornemisza, the nephew of the Nazi steel and coal magnate, was one of the world's richest men. Skipping down, in 1995, a report by Campbell and LaHerrere on world oil resources, World Oil Supply 1930 to 2050, written for oil industry insiders and priced at $32,000 per copy, concluded that world oil production and supply would probably peak as soon as the year 2000 and decline to half the peak level by 2025. Large and permanent increase in oil prices were predicted after the year 2000. Skipping down, we're now going to hear some more from Colin J. Campbell, one of the consultants involved with HIS Group, now a subsidiary of Thyssen-Bornemisza, and one of the founders of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. Quote, Campbell has laid out his prescription for various consumer governments. For example, Germany should resist green pressure to give up nuclear power at precisely the moment it needs more energy as oil peaks and declines. Germany has coal and possibilities for coal bed methane. This industry needs to be rediscovered. It may become economic again. Germany should encourage its motor manufacturers to move to more efficient engines and hydrogen fuels, especially those made by solar means. So note that Colin J. Campbell is basically pointing to Germany's coal reserves as an answer to its energy problems. And still another member of the HIS Peak Oil Consortium, John H. LaHerrere, is a petroleum consultant residing in Paris, France. LaHerrere's early work on seismic refraction surveys contributed to the discovery of Africa's largest oil field. He retired in 1992 after 37 years with Total CFI and its subsidiaries in exploration activities in the Sahara, Australia, Canada, and Paris. Total CFI basically ultimately purchased ELF Aquitaine to become Total ELF. That's one of the companies, along with Thyssen, that developed the Leuna facility. Now, bearing in mind Colin J. Campbell and the HIS Thyssen-Bornemisza subsidiary, we're going to take a look at the following. Research credit on this to a listener. This is part of the raw text of the meeting of the Association for Peak Oil Third International Workshop on Oil and Gas Depletion from Berlin, May 25 and 26th of May 2004. This is by Colin J. Campbell, this particular paper. Now, where do you suppose the Association for Peak Oil began and when? Colin J. Campbell of HIS, the Thyssen-Bornemisza subsidiary, says it was here in Germany that ASPO had its origin. On December 7th in the year 2000, I was privileged to give a talk on oil depletion at the ancient University of Clausthal in the Harz Mountains. Basically, it began in Germany on December 7th, 2000. That was right about the time the Supreme Court was appointing George Bush to be president. A couple of other items very quickly about who participates in the capital of the Thyssen firm. This is from a paper by John Loftus from his website. Former federal prosecutor John Loftus confirms the Bush Nazi scandal. Copyright October 31st of 2003. A few decades later, things had quieted down and all the Nazi money finally came home to Wall Street. By 1972, one of Rockefeller's assets, the Chase Manhattan Bank in New York, secretly owned 38% of the Thyssen Company, according to internal Thyssen records in my custody. Not a bad payoff for the robber barons. The Auschwitz investment paid off handsomely. The Thyssen Krupp Corporation is now the wealthiest conglomerate in Europe. World War II was over. The Germans won. And taking a look at the Middle East, the following is from the Wall Street Journal of Friday, January 28th of 2005. Behind the Thiessen family and the Rockefellers, who do you suppose is the third largest stockholder in Thiessen? Skipping down, this is called European Firms React to U.S. Hardline on Iran by Matthew Carniching. Friday, ThyssenKrupp, a steelmaking conglomerate, said a representative of Iran, Thiessen's number three shareholder, no longer would hold a seat on its supervisory board, which is similar to a U.S. board of directors. Iran has held a major stake in the company since before the nation's 1979 Islamic Revolution and helped rescue it from near bankruptcy with a capital injection 30 years ago. Bearing in mind the close connections between Al-Taqwa, Ahmed Huber, and the Khomeini regime in Iran, the fact that SS and Odessa operative François Janoux financed Khomeini's exile in France, it is very interesting to contemplate the Islamic fundamentalist participation in Thiessen, third largest capital holder behind the Rockefellers and the Thiessens. What we're going to take a look at now is an excerpt from Kevin Coogan's paper, Report on Islamists, the Far Right, Report on Islamists, the Far Right, and Al-Taqwa. In his conclusion, he says, "My own belief is that it's less the apparently fantastic and James Bond-like quality of this analysis that is most difficult to understand. The real difficulty is the utter ignorance of most Westerners, Americans in particular, about the very existence of people such as François Janoux. Thus, when Ernst Backes, one of Europe's leading experts in money laundering, told the Luxembourg-based economic journal Plus Minus last year that he believed the financial source of funds for the 9/11 terrorists would ultimately trace back to Swiss bank accounts established by Janoux, few Americans had any idea what Backes could possibly be talking about. For this same reason, there's been virtually no independent investigation into Sikos Baudin Dunant's relationship to Janoux or the role of Syrian-born Mohammed Mardam Bey, believed to be related to a former Syrian foreign minister, has played both as a member of Magnan Dunant Associates as well as Bey's possible links with Janoux. And what does it mean when we're told that Al-Taqwa's Youssef Nader, for example, is believed by Egyptian authorities to have worked for German intelligence in World War II? It is not at all impossible that networks first developed in the 1930s and who saw their economic power fantastically multiplied in the wake of enormous hike in oil prices in 1973 are now engaged in trying to enact a major financial shift away from the dollar and Anglo-American financial networks and to shift the vast wealth of the Muslim oil states into a new Euro-based financial network that would vastly increase the power of these banks and financial interests in Europe associated with elements of far-right elites that survived World War II relatively intact." And again, obviously a vast increase in petroleum prices will increase the power of the Islamic fundamentalists in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, the Muslim Brotherhood, which, like Thyssen-Bornemisza, is headquartered in Lugano, Switzerland, and with Bush's push to, quote, democratize, unquote, the Middle East, and with the Muslim Brotherhood also trying to take advantage of democratic process to gain control in the Middle Eastern countries, it'll be interesting to see if Bush's, quote, democracy push, unquote, in the Middle East results in the coming to power of the Islamo-fascist Muslim Brotherhood with all that implies, including ultimately perhaps the extermination of Israel, and who knows, the United States, as well as the realization of the old standard IG agreement and the Bergius process for hydrogenation. This concludes Side 2 of, for the record, 506, The Road to Lugano, Part 2. More about the Underground Reich, the Bush administration, and the peak oil controversy being recorded on April 10th of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.